Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we'll dive into the popular and acclaimed comic series, Ms. Marvel, hoping to make our minds and yours just a little bit bigger. Then we'll bring back one of our favorite recurring features, the regrettable television pop quiz, and we'll close the show, as always, with what's making us happy this week. So stick around.
Since you're listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour, I think you'll also like NPR's newest podcast, Hidden Brain. On the latest episode, Shankar Vedantam looks at the consequences of near misses and the surprising way these losses can motivate us. Plus, country singer Kacey Musgraves joins Shankar to talk about her new album and play a game of Mad Scientist. Don't miss it. Listen now on the NPR One app, on iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got superheroes and all the television you can't even bear to imagine on this week's show. But before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And with us this week in our fourth chair is Petra Mayer. Petra, what do you do at NPR?
I'm an editor with NPR Books, specializing in genre fiction.
It's always such a pleasure to have Petra with us when we are reading, and we are reading this week.
We are.
Glenn, I'm going to call upon you, if I might, to orient us a little bit with regard to Ms. Marvel and this series and give us kind of the lowdown that we will need as we go into this.
Okay. The series is about Kamala Khan, who is a Pakistani-American Muslim teenage girl living in Jersey City, who, blah, 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 acquires powers. Doesn't matter how.
It barely matters
to them. You're not going to tell us about the Terrigen Mist.
Not going to tell you about the Terrigen Mist. Not important.
Oh,
focus. No. And instead of Peter Parker struggling with Aunt May is dying again, she has the, I have a family who is very conservative in the Muslim faith, and it is a thing in my life that I must negotiate. Not deny, not cast aside.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, draw power from. Mm-hmm.
And it, when this thing was announced, it was huge. The author has said, you know, there was fan art even before the first issue came out. It has been universally acclaimed, widely praised. The book's won every award. So,
Who is behind this book?
The writer is G. Willow Wilson, who is a Muslim American herself. She converted when she was in college and spent some years in Egypt and wrote a memoir. The artist is a guy named Adrian Alfona, who I first came to know Adrian Alfona, the artist, when he drew a book called Runaways, hugely popular Marvel comic called Runaways a few years back. So good. Crucially, the impetus for this book came from the very top at Marvel. Wilson has talked about how she was reached out to from an editor there named Sanaa Aminat, who is herself a Pakistani-American Muslim who grew up in Jersey. This book has a really impressive pedigree, and it's fun.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the important thing.
And what can you tell us about Ms. Marvel as a character?
Short answer is the title of Ms. Marvel has been vacated recently in the Marvel Universe because the woman who had that title changed her name to Captain Marvel because why the hell not? And that is a character named Carol Danvers who has her own huge fan base in a book written by Kelly Sue DeConnick and illustrated by David Lopez, among others. And that's just a really fantastic book as well. But so Kamala Khan comes into this because she is a fangirl, basically. She writes fan fiction.
Right.
She
mm-hmm.
is, and just meeting her heroes is a part of the way that the author and the artist kind of set her as a geek.
All right. Yeah. Stephen, I sat next to you on a plane, which I'm sure we'll explain later, as you were reading this, and you seemed to like it.
Yeah, you could tell by the constant laughing and wiping away of tears.
Yes, Stephen was a little weepy at one point during the reading of this book.
Love this series. I'd been hearing good things about it. Frankly, one of the things that I experienced reading this was just gratitude that we do this show, because I'm not sure that I would have gotten around to visiting
There's no way I would have.
I'm not sure I would have gotten around to, in part because, you know, I mean, the first bound volume, you know, that's a $35 list price, you know, and it's, the barriers to entry are there. And I grew up in a comic book loving household. My mom was an Eisner Awards judge just this past summer. I have many reasons to have tried it. I know I wouldn't have. And I just absolutely flipped for it. I think reference points wise, I think it has some of the DNA that makes Buffy the Vampire Slayer. It has that same, like, navigating life as a teenage girl who becomes an ass kicker. There are these elements of wry humor to it. There is a standalone issue, issue 12, where they bring in Loki. Yeah. It felt like a Buffy episode, in part because it's drawing on some of the same stuff that Buffy drew on. It is warm and smart, and there are just these little turns throughout it where I'm like, oh, I'm so glad they made that decision. Oh, I'm so glad they decided to bring that in. At one point, there's the boy who likes her, and he's her best friend. And at one point, somewhere along in the middle of this run of issues, someone kind of razzes the kid and says, oh, man, you know, she's putting you in the friend zone. And he fires back with this thing about, like, the friend zone, we're friends. Mm-hmm. And there's this defense of, it's just in one panel, but it has this, like, defense of friendship as incredibly important in its own right.
There's a lot of messaging for teenage girls here, pretty specifically, I think, and for teenage boys as well. Yeah. But there's a lot of what felt to me like really trying to make sure the right thing is said for younger kids who might be reading these.
For younger kids, Wilson is very, very careful to pay all the proper respects to every group that she's covering. Mm-hmm. But this never feels preachy. It never feels didactic. It never feels clumsy. It's so entertaining. The balance it strikes is so careful and yet seemingly effortless. Mm-hmm. I can't wait for my kids to read it. This is very appropriate for kids. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The violence isn't the dark, gritty streets we talk about in other superhero franchises. I am so on board with this book.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Petra?
Yeah. I had a hard time coming up with things to say for Ms. Marvel Beyond. I love it so much. Yeah. And also, can I just humble brag? I got to sit next to G. Willow Wilson at lunch at Comic-Con this year. And I don't know how it came up, but it turns out that she likes Mercedes Lackey. Mm-hmm. So we totally bonded over magical blue-eyed horse books. I love this book for all of the reasons that Stephen mentioned. It's interesting, though, I slightly disagree with you about the messaging. I felt like it was a little bit heavy-handed, but that's because I guess I'm trained to look for these things. And at every turn where I was like, oh, gosh, that's messagey, but I love the message.
Well, that's the thing. I think the way you do messaging, when I say it didn't feel heavy-handed to me, I mean, given the audience, which I think is not primarily me. I think they are much more concerned about making sure that the messaging is clear enough for a 12-year-old than they are making sure that it's subtle enough not to be felt by me. So I agree with you that if you are used to teasing out subtext and things like this, you will find this messaging blunt. Although there is also a lot of it that isn't so blunt, but some of it is. I
did sort of feel like the storyline with the inventor, the villain, her first time out as a superhero, she goes up against this villain, the inventor, and his whole thing is that he's using teenagers as a human power grid because he's convinced them that they're worthless and the next generation is just glued to their phones and they're parasites. And I'm like, did you lift this from an Atlantic think piece? But that's me. But that's totally me, and it's actually a great plot for a budding teenage superhero.
It is a great plot, and it's also that is universal. Every generation gets treated like that and feels like they're treated like that at some point. Like every new generation that comes up gets told by previous generations that they're not doing it right. And so, yes, of course, there are clearly points where it's metaphor. There are points when I guess you can say it's blunt. But to me, it never felt too much.
I should say I'm speaking from a place of love. I love this book unreservedly. And one thing where I think it's incredibly subtle that I really love is the way that it plays with the ideas of identity and assimilation and sort of the double and triple layering of she's set apart by her Muslim identity, but she's also set apart by her mutant identity, but then she tries to use her mutant identity almost unconsciously to assimilate because the first thing that she does when she gets her powers is almost uncontrollably she turns into Carol Danvers. Mm-hmm. And it's this really uncomfortable thing where she realizes
that's to be blonde and
not her, and it doesn't work, and she can't quite make it go away.
Yeah. Well, she doesn't maximize her powers until she feels comfortable in her own skin.
Yeah, exactly. Which is great.
Two things. Not a mutant, an inhuman.
Oh,
that's
excuse me. Thank you, Glenn.
B, let's go back to the fun, for example. This inventor you talked about happens to be a clone of Thomas Edison, who is part Thomas Edison, part cockatiel.
He's not a bird.
He's not a bird. This is what I mean. Every time.
It is fun.
This thing could have gone wrong in a lot of different ways. One way it could have gone wrong is if it was merely careful, dutiful,
and
very considered. If you felt the weight of what this character represents kind of pressing down on the character itself. I agree with Petra, sometimes you do. But not often. And every time there is a moment where it feels a little too virtuous, there's her making a bad decision like teenagers do. And that's hugely important. And we've talked before about representation in the past and about how in comics, in mainstream superhero comics, when you introduce your first woman, minority, LGBT character, historically it's we're the virtuous victims, mm-hmm. and then we are the spotless heroes, mm-hmm. and only then do you get to be a rounded, real character mm-hmm. who makes mistakes. Mm-hmm. And I think Kamala Khan has a leg in both the spotless hero and the rounded, real character, and she's leaning toward that. As the series goes on, her faith kind of comes in and out of mm-hmm. her life mm-hmm. as it would normally, because eventually this is a superhero comic and she's got to punch stuff. Right. So that kind of goes away, but then it comes back in again. It comes back in interesting ways. She has to have a meeting at her mosque with...
That's a great scene.
Yeah.
With her religious leader, who she thinks is going to just give her a lecture about Satan and boys. And what he basically says to her is, if you're going to be doing this thing that you're not telling me what you're doing, you should A, have a mentor, and B, respect yourself. Again, mm-hmm. that's where the messaging comes in mm-hmm. That you're talking about. Mm-hmm. But that is such a great message. And the idea that religious faith for her is another really smart thing is when she sneaks out to go to a party where there is alcohol and boys. And the fact that she does that, she thinks she does that so that she can fit in. She realizes that all she's done is given these white kids permission to condescend to her even more.
Yeah. Right.
And mm-hmm. say, oh, well, this is you're finally out because your family isn't oppressing you anymore and you can finally
right.
do things. And they do things like give her alcohol even though they know.
Right. The way that those kids are hard on her about her faith is not the kind of front-handed way of saying, I don't like you because you're Muslim.
Right. Right.
The way she experiences that is the mean girl that she is running into is
named
saying,
Zoe, of course, because inevitably
is saying to her essentially, I feel so bad for you because I assume that this is all forced on you and you're tightly controlled. And I feel so bad for you mm-hmm. that you have to be Muslim, essentially.
Yeah.
And so it's a much more complex idea of what she experiences than if it was just a bunch of kids calling her names because she's Muslim, if that makes sense.
It's passive-aggressive concern trolling,
right.
which felt
it's
much...
totally
which
concern trolling.
Which felt much truer than kind mm-hmm. of your traditional, like, she's getting sand kicked in her face.
Right.
That scene that Glenn mentioned, where you think she is about to get a lecture about Satan and boys, and, like, that's where you really start to feel like her faith is not an impediment to her being a superhero. Mm-hmm. It is a driving force in her being a superhero. And I loved that it went in that direction.
Yeah.
Help me out with one thing, though. Okay, so I like it when superheroes work at a metaphorical level and that metaphor is right at the surface, very simple, very clean.
Mm-hmm.
Wonder Woman loses her powers when she allows a man to chain her up. Batman uses fear as a weapon because one day it was used against him and he's going to keep it from being used. Simple, clean.
Mm-hmm.
Here, when I started this book, I thought, okay, I get it. She is a polymorph, which is not one of your top 10 superpowers.
Yeah.
Okay? It's way down there on the list. It's weird. She can grow big and small. She can change the shape of her body and she can enlarge her fists and legs to get really, really big.
Kind of Plastic Man.
Sort mm-hmm. of, but it's not. It's not the same thing. It's not. There is an elasticity here, but it's not the same thing. It's a very different feel to it. And I thought, okay, well, this is exactly what Petra was referring to before. She is shifting between these two worlds, and so she must be a polymorph. She must. But that suggests that she is changing how she looks for other people. And the whole theme of this book, the meta theme of this book, is that she's the same person and that what she needs to learn to do is to invite others to help her. Then I thought, well, okay, I'm clearly overthinking this because most of the time when she uses her power, all she really does is just make her fist really big and punch folk. And I thought, well, so what does that represent? And then I thought, you know what? It looks cool. That's probably it.
I think the punching represents punching.
Yeah.
I think the polymorph stuff is a representation of she is finding who she is.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're a teenager, you are trying on different personalities to settle into the one that feels the most like yourself.
Right. And I think one of the things that I really appreciate about this book and that I appreciate about really any story is it combines things that are very specific with things that are very universal. And I think a really good story like this is taking universal ideas and they are inflected through a specific person's experience. So what she is going through with her parents, even though in their case it has to do with religious conservatism and all of that stuff, part of what she's going through with her parents is simply the process of learning how to navigate the separation between you and your parents and how to manage their concern for you versus your need to be your own person, how to listen to the things that they say without letting that be the entire way that you live your life. But they're inflected through this very vivid, specific idea of her religious family, and not just her religious family, but her relationship with her brother versus her parents. And so I think when you look at the shape-shifting, my assumption is, on the one hand, yes, it has to do, as Petra said, with all of these ideas about identity that I think are extremely smart in this book, the multiple levels at which her identity is functioning and at which she's trying to integrate these parts of her identity. But at the same time, I also think the shape-shifting represents a more general idea of, at least for me, and I say this, you know, bringing only the experience that I bring, but for me, it also speaks to the more general teenage girl problem of one day you feel like you're part of one social structure and another day you might feel like you're part of another one. So part of the shape-shifting to me is a very clever power to play with any teenage girl because of that kind of, there's so much kind of body conscious and looks conscious and people are looking at you. And the way that they evolve her look when she's a superhero over the course of the first couple few times that she goes out is really interesting to me. She sort of, it starts off, as Petra said, with this, I want to be blonde and look just like Carol Danvers. That's clearly not her. And then she moves into a more, to kind of one level of complexity to her costume. It evolves over time and you can feel her kind of finding her look. And she's not the first teenage girl to be working on finding her look. And so I think there's a lot of stuff about identity and appearance and presentation and performance that is integral to many good stories about teenage girls.
Can I also say, I think they were moving towards encoding some of her struggle into her powers, at least later on when you started to get into the idea that when she overstrains her polymorph powers, then or her healing factor fails, or the two of them are kind of operate inversely. And so anyhow, I'm slightly behind. I think I've read maybe 15 of the 19 issues that are out. But what I'm seeing in the issues that I've read is that part of her struggle is the idea of the superhero's secret identity played off against the way she's so intensely rooted in her identity with her family, with her home. She always says, I'm Kamala Khan from Jersey City. That's part of her. And you see her starting to learn that she can reach out to help. You know, she has that phone code with her friend Bruno where she calls and lets it ring twice and hangs up, and that's the emergency, and he knows he needs to help her. So I'm wondering, not having read the latest few issues, if where we're going is towards a story of her learning to integrate these two identities.
Yeah.
Because I think that's what's kind of encoded in her powers, at least if I were going to overthink it that way.
Absolutely. I want to talk about the art. This is Adrian Alfona, the artist, and when he was drawing Runaways, he was doing it in a very clean, efficient, simple, easily reproducible superhero style, the kind of house style. One of the things that's happening at both Marvel and DC is that we're starting to allow artists to shape the look of the book around the character. So what I love about this style is that it's slightly looser. There's a sketch quality to it in places. And borrowing from some manga tropes, as characters get farther away from the reader, they become more cartoony. Their facial expressions, for example, get bigger. And this whole art style is much more fluid than that very clean superhero style. I read the book digitally, where you can kind of zoom in on individual panels. There's all these jokes happening in the background. In the very first scene in the convenience store, there's a kid reaching up, very young kid, reaching up the magazine rack to the top shelf where a magazine called Ooh La La is reaching up. It's filled with
there's the serial GMOs.
There's the serial GMOs, exactly. It's all this stuff that really invites a deep, slow, rich read.
Yeah, my one critique of the art, I think the art is tremendously effective, particularly when it is working with faces and when it is trying to capture emotions, when it's capturing humor. There's a wonderful, I'm not going to spoil it, but there is a wonderful page in which you see a selfie. The humor is all in the art. Where the art loses me a little bit is in the action sequences.
I agree. I agree.
I found some of the action very unclear. And I'm reading the whole thing, imagining it as a movie. And I'm already thinking like, oh boy, they better get the casting of this girl right or I'm going to be so mad. It's a little unclear what's happening in some of those panels. So for me, the art is wonderful, but it has its strengths and its weaknesses.
And what that reminded me of is it reminded me of the way that action sequences often are in movies now, where you can't really necessarily always keep track of exactly where things are in space. You're meant to get more the sense of it. And I tend to be a person who wants to be able to follow exactly where everybody is and who's doing what to who at what point. That's why I am more of a diehard person and a speed person than a Fast and Furious person as to that aspect. I am a Fast and Furious person, generally. But I want to be able to follow the action. And I agree with Steven that there were times when I felt like I could certainly get a sense. I could get a sense of who had the, you know, who's winning the fight, but not necessarily of exactly what is going on at any given moment, you know.
You're looking at me, but honestly, I never visually understand action sequences in movies or comics, so it was all fine to me.
There you go.
But it's true. I actually didn't, I knew intellectually that Adrian Alfona drew Runaways, but like the style is so different. I feel like this title has been really influential in terms of what's been showing up on the shelves, just informally, just what I feel like I've seen going into my comic store. You know, there's Squirrel Girl, there's the latest iteration of Batgirl. I kind of feel like they owe a little bit of a debt to Ms. Marvel. What's your take on that?
Yeah. I mean, you could argue that Captain Marvel came first. The Carol Danvers Captain Marvel came first. And then this Thor is a woman now. There's Ta-Nehisi Coates is doing a Black Panther. Black Widow has a book all to herself. Agent Carter has a television show. Jessica Jones will have a television show. There's a Captain Marvel movie and a Wonder Woman movie coming out. This is part of a thing. And I don't think this could have happened, having a Muslim character, let alone a female character, kind of lead her own book and have it be this hugely successful even 5 years ago. I mean, there were. There certainly have always been women leading lead characters in books. But this phenomenon now, this burgeoning, is it's overdue in mainstream comics. I've talked before, I've written before, about how manga and independent comics are already doing this thing.
They realize that
representation is step one. We have to get beyond it. Representation. Representation is here. It's great. So, yeah, I think it's part of something that's happening. It's long overdue, and it's great.
I think we would all recommend taking a wander through this book.
It made me read Marvel comics, y'all. Glenn knows that that's epochal.
Yeah, that's true.
And if you have read it or you would like to read it, come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH or on Twitter at NPRPCHH. A lot of choices to tell us how you feel about this book or, of course, other books. When we come back, it's going to be time to bring one of our favorite features back to the show, the Regrettable Television Pop Quiz. We will be right back.
This episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour and the following message are made possible by NatureBox.com on a mission to make smart, delicious snacking easy. From Big Island pineapple to jalapeno white cheddar popcorn to pistachio power clusters, NatureBox delivers over 100 bold, satisfying choices right to your door. And all NatureBox snacks are made with high-quality ingredients and zero artificial nonsense. At work or at home, NatureBox gives you a range of ways to indulge your snacking needs. Visit naturebox.com to get your first box now.
Now that we have returned to Pop Culture Happy Hour, our very next segment is an old favorite of ours that we have not done in a while. It goes by the little jingle that I know Steven will make me do, so I will
Feel me looking at you.
I will just start by saying it is the Regrettable Television Pop Quiz.
There we go.
And this is the quiz where we each bring a, we did it, I think, on either our very first show or our second show. And we each bring an example of something from television that we would argue is at least in some sense regrettable. And then the other three of us try to figure out if we can identify what the clip is from. We have had some classics in this game, I'm not going to lie. So the standards are always very high.
I am so confident in mine.
But I would like to begin. Jessica is going to hit us with our first clip.
A mild-mannered English teacher from the main line found naked and beaten. So far from home, it just doesn't add up.
All right.
Oh. Sounds very
like Investigation Discovery.
Is this yours, Glenn?
It is mine.
All right. It's got to be some kind of true crime.
Petra got the channel right.
Oh,
it is
I did. Yes.
Investigation Discovery.
Okay. Snapped.
Nope.
Women Who Kill.
Do you recognize that voice?
No.
That accent?
I didn't. Okay. It almost sounded like Allison Janney, but I don't think it was.
Oh, it's the opposite of Allison Janney.
It wouldn't be.
Certain shows have titles that if you flick past them on the grid and you don't stop to at least watch 5 minutes,
right.
You and I cannot even be casual friends. Such is a title as Death by Gossip with Wendy Williams. The first part of this show, the death by gossip part, isn't the interesting part because it's just a reenactment show, the reenactment investigation. The conceit is that all the motives of these horrible crimes are touched off by gossip or a secret coming out. And it has the typical reenactments, you know, where a bunch of dinner theater actors are really selling it because this is their big break.
Right, yeah.
And every reenactment just sort of feels slightly off, like 15 degrees off plumb, like not full alternate universe like a Mentos commercial, but like close. Like vaguely Canadian, you know? Like that feeling you get when you're watching Property Brothers and you're like,
I want this to be a scale of unreality, like from vaguely Canadian to full-blown Mentos commercial. Can we please have Glenn's scale of televisual unreality?
What makes this show is the fact that it is hosted and executive produced by media personality, Wendy Williams. She wants you to know that she is involved in the show because every few minutes we keep coming back to a shot of her addressing the camera directly as she narrates. She is standing in a vast, featureless white space, like a Nancy Meyers afterlife kind of thing. She's standing there with her hands on her hips. Is it possible that there's a very light breeze ruffling her luscious weave? Possibly. I can't guarantee it, but it certainly seemed to me to be doing it. Even as she is imparting these forensic details about, say, a bludgeoning, the traditional role for a host on a show like this is to impart gravitas.
Right.
It's to say, this is very serious. A woman has died. We are not wallowing in the lurid details of her death. When you go to a Wendy Williams, gravitas is not necessarily the word you go with.
Right.
Like, that's
right.
Not, when you flip over her headshot, it's not like under special skills, gravitas. That's not what she does.
No.
But what she does do is emote the holy hell out of everything. She is standing there very stiff. When most hosts would get to a line like, what was she doing there? So far from home. They would adopt an expression of sort of distant puzzlement.
Right.
She goes full Shatner on it. She goes kabuki on it. And her face contorts. It's fleeting, but her face completely contorts with this look of just like she's trying to crack Fermat's last theorem. Like it's like, what? And then my favorite part, she's standing there with her hands on her hips. And as she gets to the part where she says, it just didn't add up, the hand, one hand comes up toward the face very stiffly. And you think, oh, she's going to give us a, you know, chin in the resting in the hand. She's going to give us a thoughtful like, pose thing. But you can see it happen. I can certainly see it happen. Faust says it doesn't. But I swear you can see in her eyes, as the hand is coming up, the look just says, my makeup. So the hand continues on until it is hanging in the air next to her face.
Glenn is making this, like, Beyonce single ladies hand gesture.
Y'all are missing a lot hearing this on the radio.
My forearm is, you know, vertical, and my hand is up near my head like I'm Willie Tyler and it's left. And she proceeds to gesture with a hand as she talks.
It's a hard-hitting like Willie Tyler and Lester joke.
like it's a Muppet, right? Like it's a Muppet. And then the best part is at the very end when she says, this woman had secrets. She does this little creepy, like, rubbing her fingers thing, like, ooh, greasy secrets. Nom, 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 nom. She is... My interest in the show flags. It goes like, boo, when it's the reenactment. And then whenever we see her, it's like, wee. So it is, as the kids say,
missing priceless visuals.
Giving me life.
Oh, wow. All right. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon, for that one. Jessica, hit us with our next one.
To me, it tastes like hospital food.
Wow.
It is perfectly fine for someone to just put in their body as fuel. It is not enjoyable to eat if you're, like, wanting to enjoy your dinner.
The potatoes, my advice there is get a little texture on things. They just taste wrong.
Jeez.
But I love that it was a balanced meal. I think that there are a lot of great building blocks here.
Kind of rethinking what I've done. Mm.
All right. So it's some sort of cooking slash restaurant.
It's not Chopped. No, that wasn't the Chopped music.
It's not Chopped.
America's Worst Home Cooks or whatever that show is. What?
It is a version of America's of Worst Cooks in America on the Food Network. It is Celebrity Worst Cooks in America.
All right, good.
I really like that little boink.
Yeah,
that was awesome.
That was classic. That was the sound of Dean Cain smiling.
I always wondered what that sounded
That's the sound you hear in your head all the time.
Exactly. So this is on Celebrity Worst Cooks in America. You have two teams. You have Anne Burrell's team. If you've ever seen Anne Burrell, she's the spiky blonde-haired lady on the Food Network. And Rachel Ray is in charge of the other team. This was the first episode in which each of them had a team, and they all cooked a signature dish. And Dean Cain's signature dish, he talked about being a single dad, and he said, what I make for myself and my, I'm going to say son, what I make for myself and my son, he made chicken, just like plain chicken. Mm-hmm. He made little round potatoes, and he made completely plain broccoli. Everything was just unadorned. And there's another part of that dinner, because what is happening there is that the other celebrities, along with the coaches, are all eating your food and commenting upon it. So there is a moment in which Dean Cain's food is eaten by Ellen Cleghorn.
Cleghorn! Exclamation point.
Who says, I think the choice of objects was pretty good, by which she means chicken, broccoli, and potatoes. The choice of objects,
she says.
So on this show, you got your Ellen Cleghorn. You got your Kendra Wilkinson, formerly of the Playboy Mansion. Yeah. You have your Dean Cain, your Barry Williams of the Brady Bunch, your Jaleel White.
Sure.
Okay.
Your Chris Soules, who it was not enough that after being on The Bachelor, he was on Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah,
now he has to be on this also.
There's a clear path between being on The Bachelor and Oblivion.
You got him, and these are all stops along it. And there's a couple other people I'm not remembering at the moment, but you have a
less memorable still.
Yeah, you have a collection of folks. They all sat down together to eat a meal. Oh, JWoww is on there.
Oh, JWoww.
JWoww from Jersey Shore. Mm-hmm. And they all then have to be judged, and someone is voted off every week, and I won't tell you who it was. So so that's mine. All right, hit us with another one, Jess.
Stuffed cabbage.
Half of this, bitch.
No! Can you read the instructions?
I can't.
And here's my tray. Remove tray from box. Cut them. Here.
Bitch, they are a mess. Like, I don't know if they're going to make it to the actual elimination tonight.
Did you bring this, Petra?
Yeah, this is Petra, but is this Worst Celebrity Drunk Chefs?
No. This celebrities make TV dinners.
It's an it's an elimination challenge.
Yes, it is. Can we have a hint? Are there any hints?
It's been off the air for a while.
Give me the channel.
VH1.
VH1 been off the air. VH1
has your Flavor of Love, Rock of Love stuff.
Getting warmer.
But the thing with the Flavor of Love and Rock of Love is they have spun degenerations off of the
degenerations.
Show.
Yes, I like that phrase. Right. It is in fact Rock of Love.
Yes.
Which I was addicted to before I knew of the glory that was Drag Race and the Great British Bake Off. My reality drug of choice was Rock of Love. Mm-hmm. As Stephen mentioned, was part of that whole sort of constellation of unfortunate dating shows on VH1, like maybe 5 years ago.
There was
Flavor of Love and I Love New York and A Shot at Love with Tila Tequila, all of which I watched sort of religiously. This particular moment is from the third season, which was Rock of Love Bus.
Oh, I actually watched that season.
Rock of Love Bus.
Yeah. I guess for people who didn't watch this show, it involved a group of interestingly bleached and tattooed women competing for the favors of Brett Michaels, the front man of Poison.
I believe it was competing for the hand.
Yeah. So to speak.
Or the hair extensions. We'll never know. Because his were as good as some of those women, I think. You know, he'd pair off.
Right.
I think the show started, he broke up with his on-again, off-again girlfriend of like a decade, and then they filmed several seasons of this show, and in the end he got back together with her after cultural, but mm-hmm. he would break up with the woman that he'd picked at the end of each show, and it was always because his touring lifestyle was so difficult. That he
right, yes.
So, so for the third season, instead of having them all in a mansion, he decided that the way to find the woman who could keep up with his touring lifestyle was to load all these women into a bus
yep.
and drive them around the country and make them do things like write fake wedding vows and play ice hockey with a baby Brett doll.
Yep. What could be better?
So that moment was courtesy of one of my favorite contestants, Ashley A-bomb. She unfortunately got eliminated a few episodes later, I think, because she had a boyfriend at home. But
that does seem like a good
but
reason.
Yeah, Rock of Love is one of these shows where, like, I hate the phrase guilty pleasure, because I
right.
firmly
right.
think that, yeah, unless you're mugging little old ladies for fun, you shouldn't feel
right.
bad
right.
about anything mm-hmm. that brings you pleasure. But I genuinely feel bad about my love for this show. But I can't stop watching it. I'm addicted to it.
I think that's a fair thing to feel
bad about. And honestly, I have lifted some solid fashion tips from this
one. I mean,
women.
And I say that as somebody who has my own things that I feel. I think that I typically take the same position about guilty pleasures, but every now and then I make an exception.
Yeah. You know what? I really wish that they would make another season. The best,
yeah.
actually, when I was sort of researching the show for this segment, the best rumor that, and not a rumor, the best thing that I heard about it, the best trivia fact was that one of the guys from Slipknot was invited to film a season of the show
when
Bret Michaels turned it down, and he said no.
Good for him.
All right, we got one more clip to go. Hit me.
I think they have developed a long-term relationship.
Oh! Somebody dropped the bass.
59 minutes and 59 seconds.
Wow.
And they are finished in the box.
Oh, this is that one where it seems like people have to go do it in a box, but then they don't actually.
Sex box! Sex box? Sex box.
This is a thing?
Box. Sex box?
Yeah, okay, so it's this show. Now, Stephen can correct me if I misunderstand.
I think you got it. I think you might have the concept
down. I've never seen it, but the idea was they put you in a box on stage in front of an audience, and you're supposed to go in there and engage in sex in the box and then come out and talk about how it was. But I think then I heard something where, like, they didn't really have sex in the box, in which case, what's
no,
the point
no, no.
of sex
Do not,
box?
What have I left to believe in?
What is the provenance of this
all right.
show?
So this is Wii TV. It's called Sex Box.
You know what I'm remembering right now? I'm remembering Jerry O'Connell and Jerry Maguire singing Kush Lash.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but I'm sitting here going, Sex Box, Sex Box.
I'm just trying to come up with bad PlayStation puns.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, Sex Box only lasted 5 episodes before it was canceled amid a flurry of
canceled on the Wii Network. That takes some doing.
Yeah, I mean it was very controversial. I'll get to that in a second. But basically, the concept of Sex Box is there is a giant like coitus cube on stage, but it's like this kind of silvery light up, like very large structure, and then there are these three.
They don't want to cramp you in there.
No. You got to give people room to do their thing. Three panelists. Panel of experts.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
One is like Hollywood super therapist, like right out of, like, just picture in your head a Hollywood therapist. One is a pastor who's there to, you know, I think provide a theological.
She's there to be struck by lightning, presumably.
She's there to provide, you know, your theological underpinnings that you expect from a show of this nature.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is tattoo D-bag hipster guy who in the introduction of the show, they show him like doing a pull-ups.
Okay.
And his job really mostly is to be the one who's very comfortable saying sex box a lot. It was actually hard to find a clip to pull off because all the good clips had him saying sex box a lot.
All right.
So these three they're there to sort of introduce a couple. And then they're sent into the box.
It's like 7 minutes in heaven.
Seven minutes. But there's a timer like on the screen, because what these people really need is shaming.
Yeah.
And so in that particular one, it was 59 minutes and 59 seconds that they've been in the box. They are done in the box. And then they come out. Like, the dude has like a robe
like a bathrobe on, and it's got like a monogrammed like sex box logo on it. God. And she's in kind of a nighty.
Everything about this makes me want to die.
No, it's way classier than I'm making it sound.
Yeah. Oh, really? Yeah, I bet.
And so then the panel interviews them, and it is amazingly, if you will pardon the expression, anticlimactic.
Yeah. No, I will not pardon that expression.
The discussions are so boring. It reminded me...
What did you want them to be like, though?
the comparison that I would make, and Linda, you will know this comparison, that I would draw is to Married by America. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Another trashy... This was a Fox reality show, kind of in the Joe Millionaire mm-hmm. era.
Yes, it was.
That managed to take this incredibly lurid concept, full of incredibly lurid behavior...
Marrying strangers to each other.
And then try to apply this veneer of...
Romance
and importance mm-hmm. and kind of like, in this case, like therapy
yeah.
to it. It is so weird how flatly it comes off.
If you're going to do trash, you just do trash
right.
and commit. That's how you make good trash. You can't make good trash by taking trash and then trying to be like, but our trash is the kind of trash where you learn something.
Yeah.
Like, because then it's not even good trash and you don't learn anything.
Yeah, and they still manage to get, like, heavily protested and,
right.
and treated like it was, like, the new low. The new low should not be as boring as this show.
Right, I agree. If you're going to be the new low, at least be interesting. That's a very good pick. I appreciate it, Thompson. I almost came up with the title, but I couldn't remember what incredibly obvious thing it was called. Well, those are our regrettable television pop quiz choices for this week. And
I think you came close to winning.
Yeah,
you had the concept.
I was close.
Petra, you also came close
to
winning.
Yeah, well,
Petra got the title wrong.
Petra got the Food Network idea and the Worst Cooks.
And
so.
Steven got Rock of Love, but not Rock
That's
of
right.
Love, but.
That's right. Yeah. So yeah.
So only I lost.
We all had a moment except for Glenn, which means Glenn's the real winner. All right. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of This and Every Week, What's Making Us Happy This Week? So don't go away.
Support for NPR comes from Bleecker Street, presenting the new film Pawn Sacrifice. In a gripping true story set during the height of the Cold War, American chess prodigy Bobby Fischer, played by Tobey Maguire, finds himself caught between two superpowers when he challenges the Soviet Empire. Also starring Liev Schreiber and Peter Sarsgaard, Pawn Sacrifice chronicles Fischer's terrifying struggles with genius and madness, and the rise and fall of a kid from Brooklyn who captured the imagination of the world. Now playing.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Before we get started with what's making us happy this week, we do have a little bit of show business that we need to do. We have a live show coming up that you may have heard an announcement about in our feed earlier this week, but we want to just remind you again that today is Friday, as this show is dropping. Today is Friday, and tickets are going on sale today at noon Eastern time, October 2nd.
Hope you listened right away.
They're going on sale, but, you know, it's a bigger venue. Yeah. It's at Howard Theater on Halloween, October 31st. We will be joined by Audie Cornish and Fred Armisen,
yeah,
as it turns out.
As one does.
Should be a great show. And those tickets are going on sale today at noon Eastern time at popculturetickets.org. Popculturetickets.org. So get your tickets and come out and see us. And so that's the first thing that we need to say. Now, Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, over the weekend, as we have mentioned in the past, Linda Holmes and I were in Los Angeles. We had a lovely, lovely meetup with some of our West Coast listeners. It was absolutely delightful. Turns out that people who listen to this show are great.
Also, a special shout out to our pal Jordan Morris from
yes!
the great Jordan Jesse Go mm-hmm. from the Maximum Fun family. Jordan came out and met our folks, and I got a chance to talk to him, which I always enjoy. So Jordan came to our meetup, and it was great.
Yeah, there's even an entertainment recommendation in that little bit of house cleaning. Everybody should listen to Jordan Jesse Go.
Absolutely.
When I have not been preparing for or recovering from our awards show experience, I have been updating my Spotify playlist called Songs for Editing, full of head-filling kind of ambient music for when you need to concentrate on something. And I keep falling in love with new pieces of music. The one that I ended up listening to it basically all day today by a group called Slow Meadow, which is full of that kind of Stars of the Lid orchestral, lots of strings everywhere. Song titles like Gray Cloud Lullaby, which is just exactly what I'm looking for when I'm when I'm trying to fill my head with distractions so that, for example, I don't hear Bob Boylan hitting his gong in the office all day. So we'll throw up a link to that particular playlist if you haven't already bookmarked it, but it's full of more, yet more head-clearing music for your concentration needs.
All right. Thank you, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Well, if you listen to this show and you look to me for recommendations for little out-of-the-way things, things you perhaps never heard of, skip ahead. This is not your week. This week, I am recommending Kate Beaton's new book, Step Aside Pops.
So good.
It is. And she's won every award, and everybody loves her, and everybody in this demographic, I think, knows who she is. But she does these cartoons that lay a contemporary slang and sensibility over literary and historical figures. So a lot of jokes about Ida B. Wells and Chopin and Liszt and Kerouac.
Canadian history.
And Canadian history, of course. The thing that I think makes her special is that it never gets old. The sensibility she brings is the same, but I can't wait to see whatever subject she's dealing with sort of bounce off her brain and how it will be presented to us. I mean, the sensibility is sardonic, wry, but deeply nerdily passionate about history. She has a love of the subject, and she also, I think perhaps more importantly, has a deep knowledge of the subject. And every so often, she will adopt this very familiar rhythm, this rhythm that if you grew up with Doonesbury and Bloom County and Calvin and Hobbes, you've kind of internalized. That's person one in panel one says a thing, person two in panel two says a thing, panel three is silent as they kind of react, and then in panel four, they both say a thing in a way that seems to undercut the joke, but actually just sort of compounds it. That's the Doonesbury philosophy. That certainly is. There's a Jack Kerouac cartoon in this new book, Step Aside Pops, which is Jack Kerouac, Neil Cassidy, and Allen Ginsberg are driving in a car. They're on the road. Ginsberg is leaning over the back seat, and he says, "I spy with my little eye..." dot, 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 dot. Mm-hmm. The best minds of my generation destroyed by Amanda Sarfati and Sarah Cole. In that same panel, we see Neil Cassidy kind of looking thoughtful and going, tough one, because he's trying to figure out what it is. This sensibility is so consistent. These jokes are so solid. Her art is so adorable and charming that I can't recommend it enough, even though you've already heard it. I've recommended it before. I will recommend it again. Kate Beaton, Step Aside Pops.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Petra Mayer, what is making you happy this week?
I was inspired to recommend some non-regrettable TV this week. If you are one of the five people in this cosmos that has not watched Steven Universe, it is making me so, so unbearably happy. For those of you who haven't watched it, and I know there's only five of you out there, it is a charming children's cartoon from Cartoon Network. It was created by a woman who worked on Adventure Time. I think it's actually the first female-created show on Cartoon Network. It's about a little boy and his intergalactic gem warrior aunts, and they live in a fictionalized version of Rehoboth. And it's just wonderful on so many levels. It's beautiful visually. It's beautiful musically. It's a kids show that sort of elusive holy grail of kids shows one adults can watch too, because it works on so many levels. It has wonderful representations of gender and sexuality, and I know that sounds very messagey, but like it's actually not. It kind of goes back to what we were talking about with Ms. Marvel. It's a show that manages to work beautiful, healthy, wonderful messaging about, like I said, gender, sexuality, body image into a really fun kids show that's about intergalactic gem warriors fighting monsters. And, you know, since we're also talking about Halloween costumes, I am working on my rose quartz costume right now. I've ordered a gem from a maker in Canada. I'm putting the wig together. If anybody out there can sew, I need help with the dress. If y'all hook me up, I will show up at the taping, be in the audience dressed as Rose Quartz.
Awesome.
Nice.
Because she's awesome. She's Steven's mom, and she's an ass-kicking intergalactic military leader who saved the Earth, and she also happens to be a gigantic, busty woman in a pink frilly dress with a sword and shield, and I'm flailing in joy because I love this show so much.
My 11-year-old daughter is obsessed with this
show. I love this show so much.
Loves this show.
It's only 12 minutes long, so yeah, I can justify watching it when there are other things I should be doing.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Petra Mayer. Making me happy this week, the recommendation that you can really act on is a little bit more of a punt this week. Last week, I talked about the return of my beloved The Mindy Project. This week, I am just flagging the return of my even more beloved Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which came back Sunday with an episode featuring Bill Hader that I thought was very funny. They have another episode coming up next week that I think is funny. So that is my that's my recommendation you can act on. And one more thing I wanted to mention, which I mentioned on Twitter today. Listener Suzanne sent me in the mail some physical bookmarks, which are themed around my interests. My interests being four of them are Chris Pratt bookmarks, and one of them is a Jack Wagner bookmark. And they all have little captions on them that specifically mention things that I like and care about. And she carefully sat there and made them and sent them to me. And there is something about being able to envision someone sitting there and fussing with the Photoshop and all that stuff to make a thing for you. It's an awfully nice experience. So I just very much wanted to thank Suzanne because I really liked those. And I put them up at my desk and everyone is now going to wander by and see them. So that is largely what is making me happy this week. That brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon and Petra at Petramatic. That's PETRAMATIC. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy at Jessica _ Reedy and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.
Since you're listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour, I think you'll also like NPR's newest podcast, Hidden Brain. On the latest episode, Shankar Vedantam looks at the consequences of near misses and the surprising way these losses can motivate us. Plus, country singer Kacey Musgraves joins Shankar to talk about her new album and play a game of Mad Scientist. Don't miss it. Listen now on the NPR One app, on iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts.